National Laboratory on Tuesday, April 12th at 4 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with a scientist who, for something like 30 years now, has been involved in applying scientific techniques to archaeology and art history. And his name is Garmin Harbottle. He's a senior chemist at the Brookhaven National Laboratory. He's actually retired now from Brookhaven, but continues to work in this field that he has been involved in for quite a number of years. He is a chemist by training, has a PhD in chemistry from Columbia University. And in 1949, after he got his PhD, he went to Brookhaven and spent almost his entire career there, advancing to the position of senior chemist in 1968. He has received a number of awards for his work and got a lot of publicity for some of the various projects that he's been involved in. He's here visiting the campus of the university, and as you heard just a moment ago, he will be talking in the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus. This is in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum, 600 South Gregory in Urbana. As is the case with all of the MillerComs, it's free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And here this morning on the show, as we talk about some of the same subjects with our guest, Garmin Harbottle, questions, of course, are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that would be good anywhere that you might be listening, around Illinois or Indiana. In fact, if you were listening on the internet, you could, as long as you were in the United States, you could even use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Once again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here. Once again, actually, I should say, as you were here some years back when we were in our old digs over in Gregory Hall.
Well, I remember with pleasure.
Let's talk about the Vinland map, because I think it's a very interesting story, and one that, as I understand, continues to be contentious as people argue about this map. And essentially what we have here is a map that came to light in Europe in the 60s, I believe, that shows parts of what were at the time the known world, clearly Europe and Scandinavia and so forth. The thing that makes it interesting is that it also seems to show land that was part of Atlantic Canada. No one, I guess, is exactly sure whether it's perhaps Newfoundland or Labrador, but what it seems to suggest, and that's what why people are so interested in it, that if it's authentic, it would show that the Vikings had set foot in North America before Christopher Columbus, something like 60 years before.
There had been a tremendous amount of discussion and even a certain amount of research long before the Vinland map surfaced. Going clear back, one can find books and studies all the way back to the late 1600s, as a matter of fact, postulating that the Vikings had come first before Columbus. However, as a school child, I was taught, you know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Mm. And many other people had that uppermost in their minds. I think principally people who were either of Italian extraction in the United States or Scandinavian extraction.
So it was just a case of bragging rights, what people were pretty much interested in. And there, of course, as you say, there has been some evidence suggested by artifacts, physical artifacts. And I think actually we talked about that, something like that, when you were here last, that indeed might have suggested that. But there's something rather special that got people very excited when this map came to light back in the 60s.
By chance, the map came to light just about the same time that a remarkable Norwegian couple, the Ingstads, were undertaking archaeological investigations along the north coast of Newfoundland. I'll be talking about that in my lecture this afternoon with some good pictures of them. And this was all brought up recently on a NOVA show, and they had some pictures of the inkstands. However, their pictures were posed. My pictures that I have of the inkstands were actually taken by the inkstands work party, and so I have bragging rights on those.
Yeah. The part of the mystery, I guess, about this particular map was that when it suddenly came to light, no one was exactly sure of its provenance. And of course, that's always a big issue if you're trying to judge something's authenticity. You'd like to know where it came from. And it seemed a little unclear right at the beginning where exactly this thing had come from and why it was that if it did indeed date from the 1400s, apparently no one had seen it until 1965 or whenever that was.
Actually, about the mid-50s, about 57, 58, the thing surfaces in Europe, and it gets batted around from one rare book dealer to another and one rare map dealer to another, and they take it to the British Museum. The British Museum doesn't want it. They are worried about the lack of provenance. The provenance issue, which you raised, I think is an extremely important one. It's been referred to as a black hole in the case of the Vinland map. There is no very good record. However, there are some indications that it may have come from Spain, perhaps from a private collection in Spain. But perhaps I'm getting ahead of the story, but there are a group of people who say, oh, no, it was faked. It was forged somewhere, and there are various theories about where it might have been forged. Mm-hmm.
And still to this day, people are arguing about whether or not it is authentic.
Absolutely.
Even though you and other people have made arguments that it indeed is authentic, or that it certainly looks like that it probably is, still there are people are arguing, and I know that it has been subjected to exhaustive examination of the paper and the ink, everything from the style of penmanship to the text that is on the map. Everything possibly one could analyze about it has been, and various great number of people, experts in different fields, have weighed in on one side or the other.
You're quite correct. In any scholarly endeavor like this, you have a tremendous number of scholars who get involved because they have a specialty, as you say, in penmanship. Okay, there are scholars who make their lifetime career out of the analysis of penmanship, pen formation, letter formation of certain periods of time, certain areas of the world. These people weigh in. And, of course, there's a certain amount of scholarly muscle flexing goes on here. If you're a scholar and something like the Vinland map comes along that's controversial, you want to weigh in on your specialty. And so if what you are doing, if you're a person who specializes in parchments or a person who specializes in bookbinding, for example, the binding of the book turned out to be an extremely important issue involved. So all these people get in the act, and of course they say, hey, you know, this fits in with my interests, and so I'll weigh in.
We have a caller here I want to bring into the conversation, and I want to introduce again our guest. And also, I do have some weather information that I would like to pass on. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for parts of central and southern Illinois and southwestern Indiana that will be in effect this morning, afternoon, and evening until 7 o'clock. Hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles an hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. And in the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes these counties in Illinois: Champaign, Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles, DeWitt, Piatt, and Moultrie. So do keep in mind that a severe thunderstorm watch means conditions are favorable for severe thunderstorms in and close to the watch area. Keep an eye on the sky for threatening weather conditions, and also stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest weather information and also possible warnings. Severe thunderstorms can and do occasionally produce tornadoes. Again, keep in mind this is a A severe thunderstorm watch in effect for parts of central and southern Illinois and southwestern Indiana until 7 o'clock this evening. Stay with us here on AM 580, on the afternoon magazine. That'll be our next complete look at the weather, 12:35. I believe Ed Kieser, our meteorologist, will be on duty here for the afternoon magazine. And indeed, if we do have new weather information, updates to pass on to you, we'll pass them on as soon as we get them. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Garmin Harbottle. He's a senior chemist at Brookhaven National Lab. Was at Brookhaven for most of his professional career. He is trained as a chemist. He was at Brookhaven from 1949 and eventually became the senior chemist in 1968. He did retire from Brookhaven in 97, but continues to work in this area that he's been involved in, that is applying science and scientific techniques to archaeology and art history. He is on the campus to give a talk in the MillerCom series. That's today, and we'll tell you more about that later on. Questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here in the nearby community of Belgium. We will go there, and our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, Mr. Inge had an author on his program here that I'm sorry I can't remember his name, but his book was named Cod. Okay, and he postulated that actually many people had come to this part of the world because of the Portuguese had done cod fishing in the Grand Banks, which was one of the major sources of income, I think, for the Portuguese at one time. And they had to have come to land because they would catch the cod and dry them to bring them back into to Europe. So how would they fit into this situation? Because you just mentioned it might have come from Spain. It sounds interestingly close.
Yes, the very interesting point you make. Certainly the cod fisheries were terribly important. They became more so when the Catholic Church brought in the first of the dietary regulations, which was that you couldn't eat meat on Friday. And at that time, people in Europe had to then cast about for finding something that was acceptable to eat on Friday. And the cod fishery became extraordinarily important, as you point out, at that time. The reason for the fishery here was the Grand Banks of Newfoundland, which were incredible, incredible producers of fish. We have no idea today what the abundance of fish was like, but apparently if you dropped a net in the water anywhere, you could pull a ton of fish out. And, of course, you could never get them back to Europe in time to be eaten fresh. But they had worked out salting techniques, so they made salt cod, dried and salt cod. I believe the Portuguese call it bacalhau. But that became a very important item in European diet about that time. If you allow me one moment more, at that same time, the whale fishery, if we can indeed call whale fish, the whale fishery in northern Newfoundland, the area of the North Atlantic, became extraordinarily important because of whale oil. And that oil supplied needs in Europe that were not being met any other way. As one man put it to me, Newfoundland and the northern Atlantic, whales became the Saudi Arabia of the 15th century and 14th century as well. So your caller is perfectly correct. It had a terribly important connection, and the Portuguese fishermen were certainly there very early. The Basque fishermen from the Basque part of France were also very, very early in making expeditions to the New World.
I see. So could this map be related to them?
Indirectly, yes. I think it could, because the flow of information that came back to Europe is probably reflected in some of the things we see on the map. It was very informal. I mean, these were fishermen, and obviously if you had a place that you went to fish where you drop your net in the water and you pulled out $1 million worth of fish, you weren't going to go around talking to all your pals about that place. However, they would see your boat come back loaded with fish. And they would know you'd been away for 3 months or whatever. They could put two and two together. And certainly the Basque fishermen jealously protected the knowledge and did not go around talking all that much about it. But, you know, like everybody else, the word spreads.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're very welcome.
Very good.
Nice
Thank
to talk
you.
To you.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The map, as you say, surfaced in the late 50s in Europe, and I guess it was the 60s that was when it came to Yale. Maybe that's where I got that date of the mid-60s in my head. It was purchased and it was given to Yale. And after it came to Yale, there was a great effort at that point to try to authenticate it. They wanted to know what it was and where it had come from. What, I guess, leaping ahead a little bit to the work that you did with carbon dating of the paper, that was quite a long time before it came to Yale and that work was actually done. Why did it take such a long time? Was that a matter of of waiting for the technology to develop before you could actually do that?
Yes. At the time the map first came to Yale, as you say rightly, it was in late 1950s, early 60s, and was published by Yale University Press in a very beautiful and elegant volume. At that time, the existing technique for carbon dating, first of all, was not as accurate as it is now, but secondly and more importantly, required a tremendous amount of material carbon. You would have required a piece of carbon, well, piece of paper roughly the size of the map itself. You would have had to destroy the map in order to date it. Of course, nobody was about to do that. The same issue comes up with regard to the Shroud of Turin. The inventor of carbon dating, Willard Libby, said very early on in the early 1950s that the Shroud of Turin, and then later on he said the Vinland map, would be interesting things to date, but they were impossible. Well, not impossible, but it was impractical to consume the whole Shroud of Turin in order to date it. No one was going to permit you to do that. In the 1970s, great efforts were made, including in my laboratory. We were the first people to date 10 milligrams. Now, an ounce is, 30 grams, and so that would be 30,000 milligrams. And we were the first people to date 10 milligram samples of carbon, but we did it by a conventional technique, which became rapidly superseded by a machine technique. And that's the way it's done nowadays, by the use of an accelerator.
And so you, the wind-up here is that you were able to carry out a dating on the map just by shaving a very small strip off of the bottom of the page.
We did. People who come to the lecture this afternoon will see Dr. Jacqueline Olin slicing off a piece with considerable nervousness on the part of all of us. We had rehearsed it with dummy maps, endlessly rehearsed it, and with a scalpel. But when the moment came to do it, it was a moment of nervous. On the Nova show, the footage, the video footage that was shot of that catches some of the nervousness of the situation. Well, actually, the map is valued as between $20 and $50 million by Yale. So I calculated that the piece that we cut off was probably worth $40,000 or $50,000 pro rata.
Not an insignificant amount of money for that very, very small piece of paper. Well, I hope you won't feel that I'm spoiling it, and I'm sure that people will, even if we tell them the outcome, will want to come and hear you this afternoon. Indeed, it was your determination of using the radiocarbon dating that, at the very least, the paper.
It's parchment, which is different.
Okay. Well, good. We want to be correct. That the parchment on which the map was drawn does indeed date from somewhere around 1440.
That's correct. And that was a kind of target. The reason the date of 1440 was important was that the scholars at Yale, Marston and Painter and Skelton, Marston, and Taylor, who published the original Yale volume on this, had deduced that the map was associated with the Church Council of Basel. Every so often, the Church, the Holy Father, will call a worldwide council. And he had done so in the 1430s, and the church council ran from about 1430 to about 1441 or 42, off and on. I mean, it sputtered, but there were sessions, and then people would go home, and then they'd come back again. But the scholars at Yale had decided that the map must belong to this period of the Church Council of Basel, and that's what they published. But that gave them a target date and gave us a target date. You see, if the date had come out, say, 1650, or the date had come out 1280, we would have known that it was a forgery. 1280 would mean that the forger got a very old piece of parchment and put this map on it. 1650 would mean he was copying something else. It was not an original from that period of time, the period before Columbus's time. But we had that target date, and so any other date would have been a proof, a pretty strong proof, of forgery. Now, there are 100 ways in which you can prove something is fake. There is not even one way that you can prove that it's authentic.
Yeah. And there is apparently a small window a few years either side of that date, but it's actually pretty, the margin of error there is actually rather small.
By carbon 14 standards, it's phenomenally small. And what happened, which I'll also show in the lecture, was that nature was working for us, and nature would put us into a time window where we were able to get very, very precise nailing down of the date. We were able to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, so to speak, to get that kind of a date.
Yeah. We have another caller to talk with. Let's do that. In Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I'm ancient. I grew up in Michigan. I'm calling from Urbana. And I can remember when I was a little girl, anywhere from 5 years old to 10 years old, my mother could call the butcher shop and, with other things, have smoked codfish in wooden boxes delivered. And a mother would have the salted codfish soaking in a pan. And I remember one time when I heard her shriek in the kitchen and the cat had gotten up on the sink, I guess, and had a leg down in the salted codfish that was being soaked. And mother made the most delicious dishes with salted codfish. And those wooden boxes we used to save, the lid slid out, and it reminds me of the old sort of nursery rhyme song, Clementine Shoes, cardboard boxes. These were wooden boxes for shoes she made, and I can't remember the poetry. If I had some more time, I could think of it. But you're talking, I don't think, I've never seen around here in central Illinois in the butcher shops salted cod in wooden boxes. The lid slid out, and these big chunks of wonderful white codfish.
Well, I know that the product still exists. You might have to go through some ways to get some. And also, certainly it is true, as you say, that you need to soak it to get the salt out of it. Otherwise, it would be it probably would be inedible. And it's probably, depending on where you grow up, it might be more or less likely that you had ever had salt cod in your life.
Well, this was in Michigan. Of course, it was imported, I guess, probably from Canada or someplace, Newfoundland area. But, yes, it would soak a long time, and then Mother would make creamed codfish, the chunks, and we'd have on baked potatoes, and wonderful dish.
We are also accustomed to thinking in terms of refrigeration and frozen food and so on that we can hardly remember the day when things came salted or smoked, but it was simply a matter of preservation.
Excuse me.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, do you have any idea or know that whether that industry is kaput or whether they still salt codfish and put it in wooden boxes with a sliding top off the... Oh, it was, yeah.
My first trip to Newfoundland was about, must be about 30 years ago now. And at that time, you could still see frames in the backyard of fishing villages, the backyards of the houses in fishing villages in Newfoundland. And spread out on those frames were cod fillets drying in the sun.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing to think of it, that you could do that without having a darn stuff spoil on you. But we, I have no idea. I think you would have to go to a Portuguese grocery or somewhere. Certainly in China, they eat salt fish all the time.
Uh-huh.
And they, on my experience with Chinese cooking is that they don't always remove the salt. As you know, at my age, you look after your salt, and you don't take any huge amounts of it. And I find things salty. Yeah, but it's a good point. Thank you.
Oh, yes. I'm salivating just thinking about those days.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We certainly would welcome others if you have questions for our guest this morning. That's part of Focus 580, Garmin Harbottle from the Brookhaven National Lab, senior chemist there when the time that he retired. He spent most of his career there working at Brookhaven as since receiving his Ph.D. in chemistry from Columbia in 1949. He advanced to the position of senior chemist in 1968 and retired in 1997, although continues to maintain his interest in this subject, that is, applying science to archaeology. He's here on the campus and will be giving a talk on this subject, talking about the Vinland map this afternoon at 4 o'clock in Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum. This is an event in the Millercom series, and it's open to the public. It's free. If you'd like to attend, you can do that. Questions also are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to talk a little bit more about the map for a moment, we were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that you had been able to remove a very small piece of the parchment, this was sliver, literally, of the parchment, and had done radiocarbon dating, and it had dated it to about 1440, give or take a couple years either way. And I'm sure that there were some people who would say, well, just because the parchment is that old does not mean the map is that old. And indeed, part of the controversy and debate over the map has to do with the chemical composition of the ink that's on the map. And I guess some people have tested it and said that it was modern ink. And some others then came along and said, no, actually, if you look at the way that the inks were used, were made in the Middle Ages, it's perfectly possible that it could indeed be ink from the 1400s. Is there any consensus about that, or is that still a matter of a contention?
It's a matter of great contention. I have not specialized in the ink, but I have read the papers that are involved in it. It's always been unclear to me. If you forged the Vinland map, you would have had to have been a medieval scholar of quite considerable undertaking, and there's one author, Kirsten Seaver, who believes she's located who that person is, a man who had a great background in cartography, but who knew the Middle Ages, knew Latin, and would have been in a position to forge it if he wanted to. However, such a person with a tremendous and deep knowledge of the Middle Ages would also have known how to make a medieval ink, because it's simple. If you go on the internet, you can find a dozen places where people will tell you how to make medieval ink from oak galls and iron. And this is not new knowledge. This is knowledge that's been kicking around for at least 100 years. And so the whole idea that the forgery was carried out using modern ink is ridiculous to me. If you were going to forge something and you wanted to fool everybody, you wouldn't have put a red flag down in the middle of your forgery and said, look at me, you know, I'm a fake, because the ink would be one of the first things that people would look at. And so that part really bothers me in the explanation of forgery, forgery of the ink.
What about the something else that I have read that suggests that whoever – that if it is a modern forgery, that the person who had done it didn't quite understand the the complex sort of chemistry that goes on between the parchment and the ink, because apparently a lot of the ink on the map has simply crumbled and fallen off because it did not bond properly with the surface of the parchment. And I think that some people have also pointed to that and said, well, this is another clue that it's not genuine and it might have been made in after 1900 rather than in 1440.
Yes, it's a good point. And what came out of our carbon-14 studies in the 1990s, we actually carried out the first of the dating exercises in 1995. What came out of that was that, and this was for the first time, this was new information, was that the ink in the 1950s had been covered or permeated with some kind of an oil or preservative, which amounted to about one-third of the weight of the map. In other words, if you, say, took a gram of map, one-third of that gram was a foreign substance completely. And this was unknown, and yet it had been there all the time, and people who looked at the ink with high-tech tools were essentially looking at it soaked in or permeated by this layer. And we only were able to get a correct or an accurate radiocarbon date after we'd gotten rid of this stuff. It was like an oil. We have not identified it. I shouldn't talk so glibly, but we have not identified what it is. We know we've gotten rid of it, though. And so prior examinations suffered from this hidden difficulty that was not known until our work in the 1990s. I'm going to talk a bit about that this afternoon.
You referenced the fact that there was a program done by NOVA, the science program on PBS, about the map. Clearly, it was the conclusion of the people who produced the program. Very clearly, they declared it a fake, a forgery.
Yes.
But it is your belief, I guess, with some level of confidence, that you believe that it's genuine. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. That will be the thrust of my talk this afternoon, is that the map is genuine as far as we can't prove it, but as far as we can, what we can do is say, well, this objection is not a valid objection. That objection is not a valid objection. And then you come up with something called Occam's razor, which is that if you have a whole bunch of explanations just to explain some simple fact, why not junk all those and just go to the simple fact itself? I mean, you do it in the simplest way you can. Mm-hmm. You don't postulate a thousand auxiliary issues which only obscure the beauty and the thrust of the central issue. This is very different from proving anything's authentic, which you can't really do.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some other people here who are listening. We have someone calling from Chicago, and they are on line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I just tuned in about 5 or 10 minutes ago. I hope I'm not getting off track, but I heard the woman talking about salted codfish and wondering, and not being able to find any in this area. I live in a neighborhood up here in Chicago where a store in the neighborhood was carrying some of that stuff about 5 years ago, I noticed. And the store itself may be under a different management now, but if she's interested, it's on Morse Avenue up in Rogers Park. I don't know how she, if she ever makes a trip up this way, she can find it. It's just outside, just to the west of the Rogers Park L station.
Okay, well.
And that was about all I had to say.
All right, there you go. If people are interested, they can check that out. Let's go here to someone else. Caller in Indiana. This is line number four. Hello.
Hello. A couple of things. One, in regard to the three-minute yell, who I guess by looking at the, was it the words, the usage of the words, they decided it had to be during that period of that council. I wonder if you could say something about that, what in particular they found, whether it was a certain kind of change in a Latin word or, you know, some sort of syntax thing. And secondly, it's not really been made clear whether or not you've actually used the latest techniques for carbon dating. You mentioned about the fellow on the 50. It started it and mentioned that it wasn't as specific as it could be, but now it is. And I was wondering if you have used the latest tools for carbon dating. And what about the dating of the ink? Does that make any sense at all, if it can be done or not? Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for your very acute question. And it's, actually three questions. Let me take the third one first. The answer is no. You would have to use too much of the ink. You'd have to destroy too much of the map. Our carbon date is not the ink, which is what you really would be interested in dating, and because parchment and ink are two separate things. You can have a parchment that's old and an ink that's new. But your point is a well-taken one, that what you really would like to do is date the ink, and that is not possible at the present level of carbon-14 dating. Now, moving backward to your second question, certainly, the improvement in carbon-14 technology has been tremendous. The whole idea of doing this dating only really emerged about 1975 or 76, sometime along in there, when it became possible to use the technique that we developed at Brookhaven or the technique that was developed at Rochester and in Canada, Rochester, University of Rochester. Both of these techniques would have worked, but theirs is really better. I mean, I will say that, being the inventor of the technique that is slower but cheaper. One of the machines that they use for carbon dating now will run about $10 to $20 million, so you don't find them in every laboratory. But it does a superb job, and you can work with tiny samples. The minimum sample is now about a milligram or perhaps even a little less, and that is a minute amount of material. Remember that an ounce is 30 grams, so a milligram is a 30,000th of an ounce. So you're really talking just the equivalent of a couple of grains of sand. That technique has permitted us to do very, very precise dating, but also Mother Nature helped us, and as I'll show in the talk this afternoon, nature gave us a particularly favorable part of the calendar to be working in, and that was just sheer luck. It could have gone the other way equally well. Now, I think your first question was on the usages of Latin, and believe me, they've done that with a fine-tooth comb. The best place to go into that is to get out of your public library a copy of the Yale book. It's called The Vinland Map and the Tartar Relation. Vinland Map and Tartar Relation. And the three authors are Skelton, that's S-K-E-L-T-O-N, Marston, M-A-R-S-T-O-N, and Painter, like a painter in your house. And you'll find it in most good libraries, and you want to get the one with the blue jacket on it because that's the 1995 second edition. It has a lot of new information in it.
And that is that Yale University Press?
Yale University Press, indeed.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
To another caller here. This is line one, someone here in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm curious about the date, 1440. It seems really quite late. The sagas that seem to document the Norse exploration seem to come from about the year 1000. The discovery of Greenland and the settlement there was late 900s. Am I right?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. That's correct.
And the settlement on North America appears to have been about the year 1000. The settlement in Greenland had been abandoned about 1300 or shortly afterward, and there appear to have been no more ships reaching them until their demise, perhaps in the 1400s.
You're extremely well informed on this period of history of the North Atlantic.
Is it proposed that this map is a copy of an earlier document, or why this late date. I'm not suggesting it's not legitimate. I'm just wondering why it was so late.
Okay. I will give you the accepted version of it. The late date, I believe, is due to the fact that at this period of the church's history in the early 1400s and leading up to that time, they were extremely interested in spreading the gospel to new lands and to unknown parts of the world. And the church fathers who convened the Council of Basel were really very interested in getting as much information as they could about new areas of the world. For example, an enormous amount of the information on the map is related to a trip that was undertaken in the 1250s, I believe, by Father Carpini out to the Emperor of the Mongols. Hmm. Now, to go from Europe out to almost to China, overland would be a job today, and you can imagine that in the 1200s it was an expedition. They were gone 3 years on this expedition, Father Carpini's expedition. So the Vinland map embodies a great deal of information about this mission to the Mongols. But, you know, here is the church reaching out to people, okay, and people they regard as pagans and people who had not had the benefits of exposure to the Mother Church. And so what would be more natural than to look in the opposite direction, look westwardly? Now, looking westwardly, you're quite right. The information had been kicking around in Europe for a long time. And as the discussion with the previous caller brought out, there was a great deal of informal information from fishermen, from sailors, and so on. One of the intriguing things is that there is some evidence that Columbus himself may have been exposed to this information on the docks in Bristol, England, where Columbus spent a short time. He would have been talking to sailors there, and they would have told him, you know, gee, when we go to fish, we sail across the Atlantic, and wow, you know, tons of fish there. And we've seen in the distance evidence that we might be getting close to land. And this information, I think, could have had a very profound effect on a sailor. So there is this kind of informal information that was floating around. But you're quite right. The sagas date from the 1100s, 1200s, 1300s. There were informal notices about the new world even before that. There was a man called Adam of Bremen who wrote in the 1100s that there are new lands out there. And we know this from the trustworthy accounts of the Danes. So you're right. There's a lot of information kicking around.
That the knowledge existed certainly seems probable. It would certainly be nice to have a document even that early, 1440 or so. Well, most interesting. I hope I can make it to your talk today.
Right. Well,
thank you very much.
And I think as the point the caller makes is correct, that what the map, if authentic, what the map does say is that the sort of the bottom line is that the Scandinavian sailors were here before Columbus. It's not just that they were here 60 years before, because the map dates to 1440, but clearly they were here even before that. But perhaps one of the earliest documents that we would have that would confirm that fact, that they had been here before and sometime before, would be this map. So in that sense, I suppose the 1440 is only a benchmark that's important with relation to 1492, and one should be clear that the Norse were, if they were here, it was likely they were here several hundred years before that.
Yeah, I like to use a little capsule example. I'll give it out to anyone who wants to use it, and that is that the discovery of North America by Columbus falls almost exactly halfway between the discovery of North America and the present day. Columbus is 500 years ago, and Columbus was 500 years after Leif Erikson. So Columbus stands almost at the midpoint of our knowledge of North America.
Hmm. It's a fascinating story, and as I have said, and we've talked about, that it's something that people are still arguing about. And do you expect that people are going to continue to argue about the Vinland map?
Absolutely.
For the foreseeable future?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We haven't heard the last of this. Hmm. Maybe I'll come back in another 10 years and talk to you again.
Cool. We'll talk about what's going on then. Indeed. We're coming to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes or so. And we've been talking all about the Vinland map, and that is indeed the topic that you're going to talk about. I don't know if there's some other project that you might like to talk a little bit about. Well, maybe the flutes. The Chinese bone flutes, I think, are kind of interesting. You have also been involved in doing some work on these artifacts.
Oh, thank you very much. I work with a group of archaeologists in China, and they are excavating a Neolithic site, which goes back to about 8,000 BC. And we have found musical instruments that can be played. It's really sort of exciting to hear someone playing one of these flutes. Before, we had the flute played by a young lady who was a nice flute player, but she was not a professional. But in recent time, we've had one of these flutes played by a man who's an absolute professional musician, and what he gets out of it will open your eyes, or open your ears maybe, to how far back our knowledge of music goes, how far back our understanding of the musical scale goes. Thousands of years earlier than anyone had thought.
Was this the oldest example of a functioning musical instrument that
playable?
Playable that anyone has found?
It's the oldest by thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. What exactly is it that we are talking about here? Can you describe it?
Well, it's a bone flute. It's about 8 inches long. They come in different configurations. Some of them have 5 holes. Some have 6 holes. Some have 7 holes. The 7-hole ones are basically indistinguishable from a modern flute in terms of what you can produce with them.
Hmm. Anything else that is particularly interesting that you've been doing lately you might want to mention?
Well, I work with the people at the Metropolitan Museum on limestone sculpture. We are using our techniques of analysis to be able to determine provenance of sculptures that have lost their history. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a show at the Metropolitan Museum in 2006, opening in September, that will embody this information.
Mm-hmm. We have maybe one last caller we'll get in here, someone in Indiana, Mill Creek Valley, Indiana, on our toll-free line, line 4, right here. Hello.
Yeah, since you're dealing with the Vinland map, I just have a question you might be aware of, and that is, what's the current status of the Kensington Stone? I'll just hang up. Thanks.
All right. Is that something you can talk about?
Yes. Thank you for your call. The Kensington Stone is a forgery. It's a real forgery and has been studied by scholars who know a great deal more about it than I do. But they say there's no authenticity to the Kensington Stone any more than Newport Tower, which is another one of these things. So I'm sorry if I disillusioned you on that.
Well, this is something that I'm not familiar with. What is the Kensington Stone?
I'm not sure either. It's a stone that apparently has carving of runes, which were Scandinavian writing, and was found in Kensington. It's somewhere out here in the Midwest. And I'm terribly sorry we can't go into that, but there are about half a dozen of these things. The Newport Tower is the one I know better in Newport, Rhode Island, and it's dated firmly now into the English period in Rhode Island before the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm. So just as a way of summing up, what can we say about science and scientific methods and its contribution now to archaeology?
Well, it's a tremendous amount of contribution. The University of Illinois has a very nice program going in the application of scientific techniques, and it's under their auspices, the ATAM program, that I'm here today and giving the Miller Conference. And so students who are interested in this have a way to explore it further.
Well, I will mention once again that our guest for this hour, Carmen Harbottle from Brookhaven National Lab, somebody who's been working in this area for a long time, will be giving a talk talking about the mystery of the Vinland map. And I'm sure that there's more to be said than we haven't given the whole story here this morning. So there's more to be said. In addition, some things to be seen. If you'd like to hear more and you're on the campus in and around Champaign-Urbana, stop by the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum at 600 South Gregory in Urbana this afternoon at 4 o'clock, and you can hear him. This is indeed a talk in the MillerCom series, sponsored by many units on the campus, but primarily by the folks at the Program on Ancient Technologies and Archaeological Materials. Thank you very much.
Very welcome. Thanks for having me.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from the Theater Council, presenting David Sedaris, author, humorist, and frequent contributor to National Public Radio and This American Life, live at the Virginia Theater on Monday, April 18th at 8 p.m. Ticket information is available at 356-9063. The broadcast today is also made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater. Information on the full line of Subarus available from Paul Moser or Kelly Wetherill, their certified Subaru specialist. Their email address is subaru@wardenmartin.com. Coming up tomorrow morning on the program, we'll have a health topic in the first hour. Throughout the year, we try to talk with various people who have specialties. And tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will take your questions about skin and skin care. And there our guest will be Dr. Ellen Jacobson. She is a dermatologist with a private practice here in our area. Then in the second hour of the program, we'll talk with Jeffrey Walker. He is an attorney specializing in international law. And we'll be talking about the increasing use of civilians in the military and what that means for both law and policy. And that'll be in the second part of the show. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. We always invite your questions and comments. And right now, we hope that you will stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine and the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with architecture critic Philip Noble. He is the author of 16 Acres, Architecture and the Outrageous Struggle for the Future of Ground Zero. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at prices on the Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. May wheat trading at 310 and a quarter, down 3 and a quarter. July 319 and a half, down 4. May corn 205 and a half, down 1 quarter. July 214, unchanged. September 221 and a quarter, unchanged. December 230 and a half, down 1 quarter. May beans 617 and a half, that up 3 quarters. July 624, down 1 half. November 609, down 3 and a half. May soybean meal 187.20, down 30. May oil 22.58, up 18. April feeder cattle 109.10.